From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore's top prosecutor filed charges 3 days ago against the six police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray. The police union said it's a mistake, while protesters celebrated. Will the charges influence police policies and culture? We asked Tyrone Powers, former FBI agent and criminal justice expert. Then, what happens in court now that the six officers face charges? We walk through the process and what will happen in court with a professor of constitutional law and a lawyer with the ACLU. Plus, young people have been at the core of the protests in Baltimore, but those demonstrations are not usually led by the very young. We talk with a Digital Harbor High School senior who decided to change that and get his thoughts on how the protests can sustain themselves. First News.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby on Friday announced that her office would seek criminal charges against the six officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
As the world knows, Freddie Gray suffered a fatal spine injury while in police custody. Mosby's announcement is a big departure from recent decisions not to prosecute police officers after someone dies in police custody. Within hours of Mosby's announcements, the police officers' union denounced the charges at his own press conference. Here's Fraternal Order of Police lawyer Michael Davey.
We believe that the actions taken today by the state's attorney are an egregious rush to judgment, and we have grave concerns about the fairness and integrity of the prosecution of our officers.
We want to explore how this will shape police policies and culture. With me in the studio is Tyrone Powers, former FBI agent, former state trooper, and director now, director of the Homeland Security and Criminal Justice Institute at Anne Arundel Community College. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First, the police union's lawyer, as you heard, characterized the charges as a rush to judgment. In your view, did these charges come too quickly?
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what kind of thorough review that the state's attorney did, and she indicated that she did a thorough review. I think that the timing depends on how much you're able to accomplish based on the evidence and the information and the investigators you bring in. If I bring in 30 investigators, then I can cut the time short that I make a decision on whether to file charges or not. And she's filing a charge, so it's a prima facie case. It still has to be proved in a court of law. I also understand completely, though, the FOP. I mean, that's their role, is to protect police officers. But I think they would be better served in this particular situation to maybe even have a conversation with the state's attorney to see how she came to charge so quickly, because what you do not want to do in this environment in Baltimore City is create a more antagonistic relationship between the police and the community, or the police and the prosecutor. We want no antagonism at this particular point. So before we say it's a rush to judgment or a rush to charges, I think we need to kind of dissect exactly what she did, and that might involve the conversation with the state's attorney and the head of the FOP or the FOP's attorney.
Given what the charges are now, do you expect that they'll change how police handle suspects in their custody?
Yeah, I know it will, because across the nation, and even when I did these kind of investigations as an FBI agent investigating public corruption or civil rights cases or complaints against police officers, there was always this philosophy that there was a cozy relationship between the prosecutor and the police department, or the prosecutor and internal affairs. That relationship can exist, and it should exist. There should be a relationship between the prosecutor and police and internal affairs, but it shouldn't be so much so that the prosecutor is even limited in terms of how she charged, or I have to use a grand jury because I have a relationship with these people, and I don't want to be the one that say indict or not indict. I think now that based on what the state's attorney have done, there will be a philosophy and a thought process that those decisions will be made regardless of the relationship between the prosecutor and the police. And that's a very positive thing, because just as individuals in society have to know their consequences and repercussions for transgressions, even if they know political parties, police officers should know the same thing, that our relationship doesn't mean that if something comes up, the prosecutor won't do her job unbiased.
And what impact, if any, do you think these charges are going to have on how police do their job?
Well, I think it'll make them more careful. I think they'll be, they'll dot the I's and cross the T's, which they should have always been doing anyway. And they will know that their activities are being watched. I think they'll follow policies closer. I think initially there'll be pushback, blowback. You know, the prosecutor's after us, they're out to get us. But they feel that way about internal affairs anyway. But I think in the end, it'll make for better policing, because they will understand that our work, if we do it the right way, it's not a problem. If there's any thing that we do that is not consistent with policy or consistent with law, then it very well could be pursued by a prosecutor.
Are there any particular charges that you think are going to change the approach that police take to their duties?
Well, I think in listening to her presentation, the fact that people did not get medical attention on time, or that they did not pay attention to the suspect they have arrested, I think that'll change. I think when people ask for medical attention, they'll get that medical attention now relatively quickly, and whether they're harmed or not harmed, or hurt or not hurt, will be left up to the emergency personnel. I think that'll change. I think supervisors will scrutinize the reports more. In policing, what's supposed to happen is that if a police officer does a report and there's missing some probable cause, or then the supervisor is supposed to go immediately and ask the police officer about those particular things. What happened here? What was the probable cause? Why did you arrest him for having a knife? What was your thinking? Do you know the law in this particular area? I think before, supervisors simply because kind of rubber stamped that. And now I think what they'll have to do is actually scrutinize the report and the activities of the officers that they supervise, because quite frankly, if they do not do that, they're putting their own livelihood and position at jeopardy. And I think now they'll understand that better.
And so what will people on the street see? What will citizens see if you're right about the impact on how police officers think?
Anytime there's anytime police activity or police behavior is corrected, definitely trickles down to the public. So they'll see a more professional police department if this all works out right. And of course, under the leadership and the guidance of the commissioner drawing a bright yellow line saying this is what we're dealing with, then I think they'll see a more professional police department. They'll see a police department that is more concerned about making sure that not only they reduce crime, but that people's constitutional rights are not violated. And I always have to say that, having trained police officers and continuing to do so, they're not mutually exclusive. You can reduce crime, go after bad people, and make sure that people's constitutional rights are not violated if you have good training, and if all concerned understand that they will be scrutinized not only for their work in terms of gathering evidence to convict someone of a crime, but also in terms of making sure that the constitutional rights of all citizens are protected.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Tyrone Powers, former FBI agent, now director of the Homeland Security and Criminal Justice Institute at Anne Arundel Community College. We're talking about how the charges brought against the six officers on Friday will affect police policies and culture. Sherrilyn Ifill, formerly with the University of Maryland Law School, is president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. She was on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday calling for better training of police.
Some of the incidents we've seen, the you know, rolling up on 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, who's in the park with a gun and shooting him within seconds, you know, rolling up on people who are mentally ill and shooting them within seconds. How do you engage with the mentally ill? How do you de-escalate an encounter, for example, with a teenager? How do you deal with your own racial bias that makes you believe that a young African-American man is a criminal? That's the training I think police officers across the country are missing, and they have to have it.
Is she right that kind of training is missing?
Well, two things, because police officers often use the fact that they need more training as an excuse for doing things that they know they shouldn't do. Training in the state of Maryland through the Maryland Police and Correction Training Commission requires over 750 objectives be taught and tested. So sometimes police officers simply know better, but they act outside of the law anyway. Their default is always more training, more training, more training. Training can always be enhanced. We need as much training as we can. But many of these officers who go outside of the law, who do things they shouldn't do, they've already been trained in the continuum of force. They've already been trained in how to deal with mentally ill patients. It's required in the state of Maryland that they get training on how to do that in their academies, or they cannot graduate from police academies. You can enhance that. You can make it better. You can have supervision emphasize that. You can have the state's attorney indicating that she understands that training and she's going to make sure it's pursued. More training. But do not allow training or lack of training to be an excuse, because there's no way that they have not been trained in how to do this properly. They've just been in an environment where their training, that with the training that they've received, hadn't been required of them to practice what they've been taught. And so we can't give them that default out, because they will all, every police transgression case across the nation, the first thing they say is, we need more training. And the reality of the matter is, before we automatically say that, let's look at what training they've had, so we can determine whether it's training or whether they just decided to act outside of that training. I couldn't go into court with criminal charges and tell the judge I committed a robbery, and I would do better if I had more home training, because he's going to say, that might be the case, but right now you're going to prison. So somewhere in the middle.
Let me ask you, Police Union President Gene Ryan spoke at their press conference on Friday. He was asked how police officers were responding to news of the charges. Here's what he said.
Without a doubt, I can tell you they're not happy. I mean, this decision to charge them officers is going to make our job even harder.
Do you agree with him?
I disagree with that. I mean, anytime, the reality of the matter is the job of the state's attorney is not to make police officers happy anyway. The job of the police department and for the attorney general is to seek justice, no matter who violated it, whether they are in blue uniforms or blue jeans. So the happiness of the police officers shouldn't be the concern of the state's attorney. And police officers who are unhappy with this should just change their behavior and make sure that they're doing things in the correct way. And, you know, and again, like I said, the FOP really probably needs to tone down the antagonistic language a little bit. I know their job is to protect police officers, but as we move forward with this case and other cases, they have to have a great working relationship with the community.
And we're down to just a half minute, and that's really what I think we're all wondering. How do you think the charges announced Friday affect the relationship between police and community?
It depends on the leadership of the police department under the commissioner. It depends on how he engaged police officers, talked to them about what this means, and how they should operate going forward. The charges themselves won't change the way the police work with the community. The leadership will have to make sure that what they are hearing in terms of the charges and the relationship with the community is a successful one, so we can reduce crime and protect everyone. All lives matter, police officers and citizens. They are one.
Really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tyrone Powers, former FBI agent, former Maryland State Trooper, now director of the Homeland Security and Criminal Justice Institute at Anne Arundel Community College. We've got more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Casta. Ahead, some of the legal questions raised by the charges. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Even though there's no break in the brilliant spring sunshine spilling over Baltimore, in many ways, the repercussions of Freddie Gray's arrest and death now move indoors to the courts. The most important next decisions for the six police officers charged by the state's attorney, as well as for hundreds arrested for alleged looting and curfew violations, will be made by judges. So we've asked two lawyers to help us understand some of the legal questions raised in these cases. David Rocha, senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Maryland, whose work has included litigation against the state police accused of spying on political activists, is with me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us by phone is David Gray, professor of criminal law at the University of Maryland. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. The charges brought by the state's attorney for Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, include second-degree murder, manslaughter, misconduct in office, and false imprisonment. David Gray, what happens now? I mean, will there be a grand jury, or are these the charges that go to court?
So Maryland is different from many other states in that it doesn't really have a grand jury system or doesn't have one that's used very often. So the normal way for prosecutors to proceed in these cases is to file what's called an information, which is a document that just alleges the very, very basic facts underlying a criminal offense. And once a defendant has been arraigned or had his first appearance, he has 10 days to move for a preliminary hearing in front of a judge, where the judge would hear a little bit of the evidence that the prosecutor has available and make a determination as to whether there is probable cause to justify the charge. So rather than having a grand jury proceeding before the charges are filed, we have a judicial hearing, a preliminary hearing after the charges are filed.
And so there's never a grand jury involved?
Not usually. The normal way for prosecutors to proceed, even in serious cases in Maryland, is by information. There is a grand jury process available, but it's just not used.
David Rocha, how do you expect it to unfold?
I had actually thought that there would be a grand jury subsequent to that preliminary hearing that Professor Gray talked about. My understanding is that following that initial hearing, the hearing that has to take place within 10 days of arrest, either that the prosecutor either has to indict the charges before a grand jury prior to that hearing, or if the judge at that hearing finds probable cause, then the prosecutor has 30 days to indict. But the professor is the professor, so I should perhaps defer to my betters.
Well, at least I take from this that I'm not the only one for whom it wasn't quite clear what happens next. I'm also not clear on terminology. David Gray, is it correct to call what we have so far indictments?
No, an indictment is usually something that we use to describe a charging document that's passed through a grand jury. A grand jury votes what's called a true bill, and the charging document that comes out of the grand jury is called an indictment. And that's in contrast to an information, which is a charging document that's produced simply by the prosecutor.
Although my understanding here is that the prosecutor did not proceed through an information, but through a statement of charges in the district court, and that's why, as I understand it, an indictment will be necessary, because in Maryland we have two courts, two criminal courts, a district court and a circuit court. The district court is a court of limited jurisdiction. The circuit court is a court of general jurisdiction, and some of the crimes that are charged here, the more serious offenses, are not crimes that are within the jurisdiction of the district court. But it is frequent that the criminal process begins in the district court with either, as the professor says, an information, or in this case, a statement of charges, which is an application that is brought before a court commissioner, that's a sort of quasi-judicial officer, often not a lawyer. Those are the persons in Maryland who make the initial probable cause and bail determinations.
David Gray, were you trying to jump in? I thought I heard you.
No, not at all. I think what we're facing here are a lot of subtleties of Maryland criminal process.
So I'm not a
Maryland criminal practitioner, so I'm going by my interpretation of the Maryland Code only.
Let me ask you, David Gray, if we can't quite tell how some of the niceties unfold, maybe it does not make sense to ask you about the timeline, but let me ask anyway. Do you have a sense of how quickly this process will move forward, when there might actually be trials?
That everybody agrees that we're not going to have a trial in the immediate near future. So all these officers will qualify for bail and will be released on bail. And in those circumstances where in the criminal practice we say that our defendant is out rather than incarcerated, it's very frequent that the trial process takes a while. So I wouldn't look for criminal trials anytime very soon. And there also is going to be a lot of pretrial litigation over certain evidence, particularly statements made by the police officers during the course of the police investigation. There's almost certainly going to be a movement to remove this trial from Baltimore City to another venue in Maryland, and all that takes a lot of time, and I'm sure there are going to be great lawyers involved filing wonderful briefs that will take the court a considerable time to go through. So I'm not looking for a trial anytime very soon.
David Rooker, would you expect trial or trials? In other words, will these be tried as a group?
Right. I'm sure that will be one of the things that will be litigated in the pretrial motions as to whether the cases can be tried together or separately.
And is that at the choice of the defendants?
No, it's a decision by the judge. I mean, in part, it's a decision by the prosecutor as to what they want. If the prosecutor wants it to be tried separately, I don't think the defendants have any ability to consolidate it. However, often prosecutors want to proceed together. I don't think we yet have any indication of how the state's attorney's office will proceed here, though it would not surprise me at all if they wanted to try them together. If they did, the defendants might seek to contest that and to sever the different cases, and then that would be litigated and decided by a judge.
David Gray, will there be anything unusual about jury selection? You said you expect the trial to be moved out of Baltimore.
I would imagine that the way that venue is changed or the trials are removed in Maryland is usually that a defendant makes a representation to the court that he or she doesn't believe that he or she can get a fair trial from an impartial jury in the jurisdiction where the trial is scheduled to be held. And then a judge, if the judge finds reasonable grounds for that view, will order removal of the case. And it seems to me a pretty straightforward proposition that it'd be quite hard to have an impartial jury impaneled in Baltimore, particularly after all of the events surrounding these charges.
David Rooker?
I'm not so sure I would be prepared to accept that proposition, but leaving that aside, I think it's important to also note that the vast majority of criminal cases against police officers that I'm aware of, both here in Maryland, the defendants have opted not to have a jury trial and to have the case tried to a judge, and that may affect the venue analysis.
That's David Rooker, staff attorney with the ACLU here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is David Gray, professor of criminal law at the University of Maryland. We're talking about some of the legal issues now in the Freddie Gray aftermath. We learned yesterday in the Baltimore Sun that the investigative team at the Baltimore City Police Department was busily continuing their work Friday morning and were caught completely by surprise when State's Attorney Mosby announced the charges. David Rooker, what are some of the pros and cons of a prosecutor taking more or less time?
Well, I think in this case, as in every case, we want prosecutors to only bring charges when they believe they have a legitimate basis to do so. In this particular case, I have to say that I think there's a lot of people professing shock, and to me, it's somewhat shocking that we're shocked. That is,
explain that.
It seems to me that what we have here is a case of police officers being treated like every other defendant that comes before the criminal justice system. And the fact that that's shocking is itself shocking and troubling. So it is common what we had here, there was no question that a death occurred. And I think there was little, and clearly once the medical examiner had ruled, no question that a homicide had occurred. And we know the universe of people who were potentially culpable. So the only question was there any possible culpability in this homicide? And once that evidence was sufficient to establish probable cause that there was culpability, not to mention the other offenses that happened here, which are significant, but once there was enough evidence to establish probable cause that there was culpability in this homicide, then if it had not been police officers involved, I guarantee you that an arrest would have happened immediately. And it is only because in this society we have this presumption that police officers act with propriety, and that we are unwilling to contemplate charges against them unless there is ironclad proof at the outset that they haven't. Frankly, that's why we're in this situation right now. And the fact that we now have police officers being treated like you and me and anyone else would be, I think is a good thing and the right thing, not the wrong thing.
Let me ask David Gray his thoughts on this, and also, David Gray, whether any of the charges, the particular charges, surprised you.
So none of the charges in themselves surprised me. If anything, they were a little bit revealing in terms of what the investigation conducted by the state's attorney and the police department reveal in terms of the underlying facts. And I will, perhaps with a little bit less vehemence, concur with David that this is a circumstance where descriptively we're all surprised, but as a moral or normative or a social matter, we shouldn't be in a position where we would be surprised by charges coming quickly. And it is in many ways a good thing that the state's attorney seems to be proceeding as if this were any other case. And one thing I will add is that it's been very reassuring to me that the state's attorney has made her public announcement, but otherwise hasn't been all over the press talking about these cases. And that to me reflects a considerable professionalism by her and her office that I find very reassuring.
I read that the most serious charge, second-degree depraved heart murder, which was lodged against Officer Caesar Goodson Jr., who was driving the police wagon, I read that that does not require prosecutors to prove intent, even though it is a murder charge. David Rocha, do any of the charges lodged require proof that the officer involved intended to hurt Freddie Gray?
I don't think that any of the charges require that specific intent. There was the depraved heart murder, which requires an extreme level of recklessness. There was the negligent homicide, manslaughter, which is a reckless homicide. So all of these charges are premised on an indifference to the harm that you are causing, which I think is precisely right. That is, that's what this is all about, both at the micro level and, frankly, at the macro level. I think the one charge that I think is also interesting, though minor, in comparison to the universe of charges here, is the charge of false imprisonment for the illegal arrest. I did a little bit of looking. And the last Maryland Court of Appeals case I could find on that was from 1958. And in the 14 years that I've practiced civil rights law here in Baltimore, I don't recall a single instance of an officer ever being charged with false imprisonment for an improper arrest. And I think that is perhaps a little notice charge that I think has potentially a lot of significance.
David Gray, do you agree that's a significant charge here?
So I think that that was an important charge for the state's attorney to bring, and she emphasized it in her press conference, just making the point that there was no probable cause under Maryland law to arrest Mr. Gray in the first place, that the knife that was in his possession was lawful for him to possess under Maryland law, and therefore, as an objective matter, there was no probable cause. Now, there was a Supreme Court case last term called Hine versus North Carolina that may present some issues in terms of the prosecutor's ability to meet her burden of that charge. But as a matter of describing the events and condemning them in terms of the criminal law, I think that's a very important charge for her to bring.
Well, and that sort of raises the question in my mind. We're accustomed, again, in terms of comparison of this case to regular cases, we're sort of accustomed to hearing about criminals being alleged criminals being charged with a whole bunch of charges so that prosecutors have something to bargain with. David Gray, do you think that's part of what's going on here?
So the only charges that I think you might look at and think that are the second-degree murder charges, the manslaughter charges, and the negligent homicide by vehicle charges. And you might think of those as charges that cover the same facts and are increasingly severe, but really it's just a circumstance of a prosecutor alleging that the defendant was reckless in this case, that he was aware of a substantial and unjustified risk, that his conduct or omission presented a severe risk of death or bodily harm to Mr. Gray and went ahead and did it anyway, and whether that recklessness was so severe that it constitutes depraved heart, that it was normal sort of recklessness, which would be manslaughter, or that maybe he was not completely aware of the risk he was presenting, which would make it negligence. Those are classic questions for the jury. So I wouldn't look at this as a circumstance of laying on charges in order to strengthen a bargaining position at plea bargain. This is the prosecutor saying, I think that he acted recklessly with depraved heart, but I understand that a jury might look at the facts slightly differently when we come to trial.
I want to get at some of the issues involving many of the other folks arrested in the last couple of weeks. Paul DeWolf, the chief public defender, told Maryland Morning that he considers the high bails set for the protesters a problem. DeWolf said, quote, for example, the officers who were charged in the death of Freddie Gray have been released on bail, while most of the protesters who have been arrested remain in jail due to their inability to post bail for pretrial release. These protesters include legal observers and curfew violators with no prior record, close quote. I mean, the bail for the police officers, some of them, is around $250,000 or $350,000, while one 18-year-old who smashed a police car is being held for $500,000 in bond. David Rocha, what do you think about this?
I think Paul DeWolf is absolutely correct. I mean, the bail amounts that are being set here are extraordinary, out of whack with the charges being levied, and it's hard to reconcile the fact that officers accused of murder get a lower bail than protesters and even curfew violators. You know, I mean, not everyone of the 480-something people arrested in the last week, a minority of those folks are people to have alleged in rioting. The vast majority of those arrests, overwhelming, is curfew violations. And the curfew violations have been almost entirely nonviolent, and we saw plenty of people arrested who were simply exercising their First Amendment rights to protest the curfew. In fact, the curfew itself had become a source of protest, I think, within a few days of Monday's unrest. And so the bails that are being set, and the fact that the 24-hour rule is not being adhered to, that is the requirement that someone who's arrested be brought before a judicial officer for a probable cause determination within 24 hours and for bail. These are extraordinary. I question the governor's ability to suspend that rule, since it isn't an executive rule in the first place. It's not a statute. It's not an executive action. It's a judicial rule. So there are significant separation of powers issues here as
well.
It
is a tribute to both of you as lawyers that you have filled the time, and I have not gotten to ask you all my questions, so I hope I can talk to you again. David Rocha is senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Maryland. David Gray is a professor of criminal law at the University of Maryland. I appreciate your both talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've got more information on our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, including links to some of the news stories we mentioned. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, we talk with a high school senior who organized a peaceful march. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
To the youth of this city, I will seek justice on your behalf. This is a moment. This is your moment. Let's ensure that we have peaceful and productive rallies that will develop structural and systemic changes for generations to come.
That was Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby last Friday, wrapping up her announcement of criminal charges against the police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray. A few hours later, we talked to one of the young people Mosby was calling out to. Darius Craig is a senior at Digital Harbor High School, president of the student government there, and the National Honor Society. He organized a march last Tuesday.
Sitting home watching the stores being broken into, the buildings being set on fire.
On Monday.
Yes. Being that I'm a student leader, a lot of my peers contacted me saying, okay, what are we going to do? You know, we have to stand up against this. And that night, I contacted my administrators, friends, teachers, and we decided that we were going to march from my school, Digital Harbor, to City Hall. And pretty much the entire time we marched, we chanted, "We love Baltimore," because that's what we wanted everyone to see, our pride in our city. We're building a better image for the youth that we're not thugs or juveniles.
You just mentioned thugs, and we know what a charged word that is. Did you take it personally when the mayor used the word thugs about the looters?
Well, the mayor had a lot of, things on her mind, a lot of built-up emotion. So I think that, I honestly don't think she meant to say that, but she had to find some way, some way to describe the children. I didn't take it personally because I know I am not a thug. I don't partake in any criminal activity. I thought it was a bad word to use, but...
Why?
Because, when you think of thugs, you have this bad perception. It's usually, in today's society, when you describe a thug, you're describing an African-American male, baggy pants, cursing, spinning, swearing, doing drugs. That's not what we saw. We saw a lot of angry teens express their emotion in the only way they knew how. And I don't feel that it was fair to call them thugs without asking why are they doing this? What motivated them to do this?
Do you feel like you know what motivated them to do it?
Yes. It's anger. It's built up anger. When you witness things such as police brutality in our schools, in our streets, when you see it on the news and you see the victims not given the justice they deserve, this is anger that's built up. This is anger that's been built up in the black community for this generation and decades of generations before us. So we saw the result of anger and mistrust.
That's Darius Craig, a senior and student government president at Digital Harbor High School here on 88.1 Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. So you understand anger that's built up, and yet if you're marching from Digital Harbor to City Hall saying we love Baltimore, that's a really different message.
Yes. In a way, what we myself, my group, we expressed our frustration in a more positive way. I can say that I understand why those students, those teens felt that they had to do that. I'm not saying I justify it, but I understand why.
What has the sentiment been in the hallways of Digital Harbor the last week?
Starting with the riots on, the students, I don't think they felt safe, let's say downtown, especially with the increased police presence. People were like, okay, they're rioting, they're supposed to be bringing it downtown. Most of the students at my school want to just go home, not be part of any of that.
When you say not safe from potential rioters or not safe from the police, or is it all together?
Well, as I said earlier, a lot of people don't trust the police, so when you have all of these rioters and protests, then all youth, as they've been this past week, all youth are categorized as violent protesters, rioters. So they didn't want to be caught in that crowd. They wanted to go home, be with their families. You know, they didn't want to have anything to do with the violence that we saw.
So the announcement of criminal charges, does that feel to you like some kind of a turning point?
I do. I feel that way. I can honestly say I was surprised, but I'm pleased because, you know, reading the list of charges, that really shocked me. And I'm pleased that, you know, it's not over. It's not over. These officers still have the right to due process, a trial. And so we at this time, we don't know how long they'll be in prison. We don't know their sentences. So I think this definitely is a turning point, but it's not over. We're not out of the woods yet.
So what do you intend to do next?
I want to keep my eyes on the news, keep my eyes on the prosecutor, the mayor. You know, I want to know how this will pan out, what will happen to the officers, and if this will give the city the answers that they want, that they deserve, that the Gray family wants, that the Gray family deserves in the world.
There's been a real outpouring of intensity and sort of focused thought in demonstrations and protests over the last couple of weeks. Do you expect that to continue? Not perhaps the demonstrations, but that focus and intensity?
I do. What these riots, these violent protests have done, they've brought the city together more in a way that I've never seen before. When you have these gang members come together, when you have Christians and Muslims come together, blacks and whites, at my march on Tuesday, there were just different people the entire way. There were Caucasians, African Americans, we had a couple Hispanics, and it felt great that we could all come together for this common cause. And you have to go through hell before you get to heaven. So we just seen a lot of destruction, which in a way made a more bright future for Baltimore, because we now know that, okay, this is what we have to do. We have to get with our neighbors, people that we probably thought we never would work with. So we saw communities come together. We saw parades in the streets. That's beautiful. That's what Baltimore is about. That's what I think Baltimore is going to continue to be in the future.
Thanks for talking to us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Darius Craig is a senior at Digital Harbor High School, president of the student government and the National Honor Society. He plans a career in politics. We've got a recording of and a link to the text of the speech he gave at the protest he led at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Yesterday was May 3rd. On that day in Maryland history, Baltimore's own Cab Calloway recorded Minnie the Moocher, one of his most famous songs. We're continuing our coverage of the Freddie Gray case tomorrow. Please join us.